So today I'm going to try to convince you that considering religious practice, even serious religious practices, games is neither trivial nor sacrilegious. I hope that I can leave you with a renewed commitment to the values and practices of our liberal religion, our liberal religious community, and I think I'm off to a good start. So, it appears that dice predate writing. Casting lots is mentioned over 70 times in the Old Testament, often in conjunction with determining God's will for a given situation. It was the casting of lots that got Jonah thrown overboard to be swallowed by a whale. The New Testament includes fewer cases, most notoriously soldiers casting lots for the garments of Jesus. However, Christians are never instructed to cast lots or to rely on mechanisms of chance in conjunction with religious practice, presumably because they already have the exhaustive, infallible Word of God. Let's see if this works. Is it slot? Hey, there we go. We got it. I come to this topic by way of a personal obsession. I have a few games. I run an after-school game club at Balls Bluff Elementary. I started a local game club, which meets religiously every Wednesday night from 6 to 9, to teach and play strategy games. And, you know, that's actually a plug. You're welcome to come. I'd love to see you. Most importantly, I met my lovely fiancé via game nights, introduced by a mutual friend. For 6 months, she's been a patient supporter and sounding board as I tried to develop the ideas for this sermon. So needless to say, this is an authentic place for me, and I hope that I can share it with you. And you think I'm not going to make good on my promise to the kids, don't you? The Ankh, pronounced like dank without the D, is an ancient Egyptian hieroglyphic ideograph with the meaning life. The Egyptian gods are often portrayed carrying it by its loop or bearing one in each hand, arms crossed over the chest. The Ankh appears in hand or in proximity of almost every deity in the Egyptian pantheon, including imagery of pharaohs. The Ankh was the 16th space of the Senate board. I say was because Senate is a dead game. We don't have the rules. It's arguably one of the longest running games in the history of the world, as it was played continuously, even religiously. Got another pun in there. From 3000 BCE until about 100 Common Era. It's like rudimentary backgammon where you try to move your pieces off the board. Notice the sticks there. Those are probably the oldest example of dice. They predate knuckle bones, where you'd paint a flat stick on one side and the side that came up painted was counted as your score. That's how you'd move your pieces forward on that board. Just a little detail. Senate was played by the rich and the poor. Even those who were less well off would stretch graffiti boards in the ground or onto slabs of stone or broken pottery. We even have a few examples where board priests scratched the game into the floors of temples. King Tut was buried with 4 Senate boards in his tomb. This is a mural from the tomb of Queen Nefertiti of the eponymous queen playing the game. As an aside, murals, mainly in tombs from the wealthy from the period, uniformly depict winning the dead winning the game, contrary to the expected statistical outcomes. But better for business if you're a tomb painter. And I might have borrowed from this tradition as we played the topic selection game earlier. Ultimately, the board and pieces of Senet made their way into the pictographs themselves of the ancient Egyptians. The symbol of the board is translated men, which expresses the concept of persistence over time, and like less in the sense of persistence in the face of adversity or hardship, and more in the sense of longevity. The Egyptians were all about longevity. During the Old Kingdom, the departed may have simply counted on this recreation to help them spend the idle eons of the afterlife. After all, eternity might get a little boring at times. For New Kingdom mummies, however, Senet became the ticket to paradise. Their owners took this simulation of their lives and afterlives on the game board so seriously that they used it for their most important magic. Many tomb paintings and vignettes in mortuary papyri from that time depict the deceased playing Senet against an unseen opponent for the ultimate stake of his admission to eternity. See, the surprising point for me is how this cultural obsession was translated and conveyed as a religious practice in game. Right? It was played seriously. It was played obsessively. People did it all over the place, but it became both life and a symbol of it for these people. And it's not bad for a glorified game of chutes and ladders, right? Especially because games are pointless, right? What do you get out of a game? So what's a game? For a working definition, and this, the hard part is to wrap your head around some of these verbal descriptions, so bear with me. I propose that a game is any engaging activity lacking direct utility with actions directed or defined by rules. Okay, I'll just read it one more time. A game is any engaging activity lacking direct utility with actions directed or defined by rules. I left this pretty loose, right? This includes Monopoly, some forms of dance, some forms of song. You might have experienced that a little bit earlier. It also includes this time-honored game of pretending that we're better than we are while looking for evidence that our neighbors are worse than they really are. You don't get anything directly from playing a game. Wagering, in the case of cards, is indirect, right? The card play doesn't produce anything of value. This is why the idea of a quote-unquote teaching game is an oxymoron, like military intelligence or jumbo shrimp. Have fun with your flashcards, you New Testament readers. When you play a game, though, you do things. Ideally, you get to make some interesting choices. Another sort of contrast to this and religious practice is to remember that running a church is not a game, right? Sitting on the board, writing the bylaws, doing the service, building the church has direct outputs. And that is a form of religious practice, but it's not what I'm talking about. And this is an opportunity to really call out those that serve and support us and the contributions that we give to make our religious worship possible. But it is not religious worship. In some ways, religious services can be seen as a game. Part of the reason why I had Mr. Kopp read our articles is that before you can even get going, you have to know your goals. All right? It's critical. If you're going to play chess, you have to understand that you're trying to beat the other person by moving pieces around a board. That's usually enough. I could go on for an hour about the criticality of the goals of game design. Why are we here? We talk about it a lot. And I think it's worth sort of reemphasizing that as written down, we are united in the search for truth and a devotion to universal fellowship. We regard as essential the freedom to express individual beliefs and the practice of democratic process in human relations. Through the sharing of thoughts and ideas, we strive for a growing philosophy, strength of character, new opportunities for service, and a richer life for ourselves, our children, and all humanity. So, insofar as we're playing a game, if we don't achieve those ends, we really need to reevaluate what we're doing. We need to evaluate the rules and our conduct to ensure that that's the end that we arrive at. Here's another thing. Rules are predefined. If you're a game nerd, you'd like games with rules for making rules. But people aren't good at learning them. Just as an example, I'm sure I've already lost some of us, not because, I am a little obtuse, but I'm just like our minds wander. It's difficult to keep track of more than one thing at a time. And so to learn, we really have to bring ourselves in. We really have to engage, to play the game, to understand. And it's partly because reality is complicated. Reverend Dan King is way ahead of me today. I wore this little pin that I have here. It's an award for participation in Rotary. Not that I'm a great guy, I gave him money. But the role that I play in Rotary is, it's called the sergeant of arms. It's sort of like I'm the enforcer. I show up and I structure the meeting. I ensure that people follow the rules. And if they don't, the game is that they owe me a dollar, right? I don't get it. It ultimately goes to charity and the scholarships that we support. But without that, you can't play. There's no safe space. Kierkegaard, if you're going to let me just be nerdy for 1 minute, he wrote about the story of Abraham. In this context, he said the story of Abraham contains a teleological suspension of the ethical. That's what you get for a safe space when you define rules and boundaries. Genesis 2:22. Then God said, take your only and beloved son Isaac and go to the land of Moriah. Offer him there as a burnt sacrifice on one of the mountains. I will show you. When they reached the place God told him about, Abraham built an altar, and on it he arranged the wood. Then he tied up his son, and he laid him on top of the wood on the altar. Then Abraham reached out his hand and took the knife to kill his son. But the angel of Yahweh called to him from the sky, "Abraham, Abraham," and Abraham replied, "Here I am." Right? A safe space is not necessarily a good or a bad thing. It gives us the ability to suspend disbelief. It gives us the ability to engage in ways that we wouldn't ordinarily engage. Right? It's value neutral. And so this kind of raises the biggest specter of this discussion. Where's our party beads? Are they all gone? Right? The selection of the beads was intentional. Mardi Gras is a safe space. You know, for all the drinking, for all the flashing, for all the crazy things that go on, that is a defined religious activity that gives meaning and purpose to the period that follows after it. And not all the outcomes are necessarily good. Not all games are equally good. However, our religious activity should not be limited to pretending to and for each other that we're better than that we really are. In fact, I think our religious activity should provide safe spaces to be worse. With rules and a goal, we can do anything. We can explore things that we wouldn't ordinarily or shouldn't ordinarily do. You know, my daughter is sort of a fragile creature, and I won't tell the story when she's here for the next service. She's always had a hard time getting out and engaging. And so for the longest time, I was trying to figure out how to frame things for her. The fear of being hurt, the fear of injury prevented her from exploring. And then one day I just sat her down and said, "Sophie, if you don't get hurt, you're probably not having fun." This has yielded some unexpected rewards. It means that she'll come in and show me her boo-boos with pride. She'll tell me the story about how she got lost on a on a raft in the sea out at Maine. It has given her an opportunity and a way to explore in ways that she couldn't otherwise. And there's necessary danger with that. But I think the exchange has been for the better. Let's think of ourselves. Inclusion has been our goal. Not just us, really UUs everywhere. That's the one thing that we really share. We are aggressively inclusive. But inclusion is about bringing in. We should now be thinking about going out. We should turn ourselves inside out to turn the world upside down. Transforming our culture will include many of the activities that are already a part of our UU lives. From inviting people to join our congregations to political organizing and volunteering for charity. These can all be parts of a larger cause to build a culture of liberality by encouraging individuals to live by the liberal virtues such as openness and solidarity, respect for the truth, humility, reverence and awe, gratitude and generosity, and self-awareness and self-possession. We aim to change the world by creating a humane culture that sustains all people, not just in here but in our congregations, but out there too. But we're going to step on each other's toes. In running of the church, there's inherently a degree of conflict as we make poor choices, as our judgments impact others. But as a commitment that we've all made, and you know, I've printed these out so we all can have them. As a condition of membership, we will abide by the covenant of loving relations. Take it home. Put it on your fridge. Think about it. This helps us keep the safe space, helps us stay together. And as we close in a benediction, I'm going to be reading our covenants to remind us of the commitment that we've made to each other to grow and to change the world. Amen. Our covenant. We support each other in times of joy and in times of need. We treat each other with kindness, respect, and compassion. We own and speak our truth and are respectful of the truth of others. We acknowledge that all people's presence is a valued contribution to our community and that each person's degree of participation will vary. We acknowledge our mistakes and shortcomings, and we seek and offer forgiveness. In moments of disappointment, anger, or resentment, we strive to assume the very best intent of everyone involved. We agree that conflict is a natural part of congregational life. We step back and reflect on our feelings in times of conflict, and we refrain from disparaging one another. We further commit to adherence to a conflict resolution procedure. Blessed be.